make them anymore. Li Wei beats me in our first game, and I insist upon a second, which I also lose. I sign to my defeated army in exasperation. What are you doing to me? You lost us the game! A sound draws my attention, and I look up sharply to see that Li Wei is laughing. Just as his cry of mourning conveyed grief so perfectly. His laughter is full of a joy that soon makes me start laughing, too.
My little general, he says.
Although he is teasing, there is something warm in his eyes that suddenly makes me acutely aware of how close we've drawn to each other. It was out of necessity, needing to be near the light as we played, but our arms practically touch as we lean over the board. Our fingertips are only a few inches away from each other. A rush of heat goes through me, and it has nothing to do with the fire. We should get some more rest, I say, pulling away. I'll take the first watch. I'm pretty sure I can see a flush in his cheeks. He nods in agreement, and soon curls up and sleeps. Once again, I have to fight the urge to watch him, and find other things to distract myself. We switch halfway through the night, and I fall asleep easily, with no dreams this time. When morning comes, I wake to find Li Wei gone. Panic hits me, and then I hear footfalls and see him approach through the lingering fog.
Sorry, he says, seeing my expression. I just wanted to look around. You won't believe what I found farther around the mountain.
What? I ask.
A mine entrance, an old one. It doesn't look like it's been used in a while.
There must have been people here then, I say, searching around, as though I expect them, too, to appear through the mist.
At some point,
he agrees.
I didn't go in, but the mine doesn't look nearly as big as ours. Do you want to look around before we go?
I hesitate. We're down to one meal pack, and lingering puts us farther away from getting to more food. And yet the mystery of the mine is too alluring. Who would have worked in it? Certainly no one from our village. Did workers come up from the township? Or is there some settlement here on this forested plateau? We need more water as well, so we agree to make finding it part of our exploration. We split the last meal, and as that food disappears, I find myself thinking of the village we left behind. A full day has gone by now, and our absence will have long been discovered. What will people think of us? What will Zhang Jing think? Will my note be enough to maintain her faith in me? A sound I've learned to recognize by now soon alerts me to a water source. I steer Li Wei toward it, and we find a small trickling tributary that runs through the plateau. He looks impressed, and I can't help but feel a little pride as I fill our canteens.
I wouldn't have found that nearly so quickly, he admits.
I hand him his canteen and tuck my own away. I guess I'm of some use after all. He smiles at that.
General, you've long since proved your use.
Don't call me... My hands drop as my eye catches something in the trees beyond him. Seeing my change of expression, he turns, searching for what I noticed. Soon he sees it too, the large looming shape of a building on the other side of the trees. Turning back to me, he meets my eyes, and I give a quick nod of agreement. We head in that direction, and find not one, but many buildings. We have stumbled onto a small village, much smaller than our own, but clearly meant to have some permanency. The implications of this are staggering, and we both stare around wide-eyed. No one in our village has had any contact with the outside world, short of the linekeeper's notes. Entering the settlement is akin to having fallen into one of the magical lands in the old stories.
No one's been here for a while,
Li Wei says, pointing at some of the disrepair on the buildings. I see instantly what he's referring to. The wood is worn, even rotted in some places, and the elements have long won out. We split up and walk around, and I feel a mix of both excitement and apprehension. Once again, I find myself thinking in terms of the record, how I would report on this amazing discovery. For the most part, the little houses are built similarly to ours, but I spy minute architectural differences that fascinate me. I wish I'd brought ink and paper for notes. I'll have to rely on my own memory to share this when I get back home. I find a house with a door hanging ajar, having rotted out of its holdings. I push it all the way open, and again hear that sound doors make that I have no word for. Inside the house reminds me of the modest home Zhang Jing and I grew up in. It is built with three bays, and a deteriorating screen blocks the rest of the house from my view. There is a large clay stove that has been cold for some time, and looks as though its most recent use was by nesting birds. A small shrine marks where the household god sat, with burned-out clumps of candle wax. I pick up a statue nestled in the shrine. It's mostly made of ordinary clay, but the detail in the carving is exceptional. It is a Pishu, its leonine head held proudly up as its mouth opens in a roar. Rubbing off some of the dirt on it, I see that the horns and wings are tipped with gold. Li Wei will want to see this, if only to admire the craftsmanship. Taking it feels a little like stealing, but it is clear no one has been here for a while, and the statue has been abandoned. Holding it in one hand, I walk over to the screen that separates this living space from the sleeping area. The screen is worn and rotting, with no design or ornamentation. When I touch it to move it away, part of the screen crumbles, and the whole thing collapses, kicking up dust. I step back, coughing and covering my face. When the dust finally settles again, I blink a few times, and at last get a glimpse beyond the screen. And find myself face to face with a family of human skeletons grinning at me with sightless faces. Chapter 8. A scream catches in my throat, and I back up as quickly as I can. The little Pishu statue slips from my fingers and hits the floor with a thud. I barely notice. I want nothing to do with this place. I need to get out. I run through the living area and out the door, and straight into Li Wei. For a moment, I'm so panicked that I don't even realize it's him. I start to struggle against him. And finally still, when a glimmer of familiarity, the feel of his strong arms around me, is able to penetrate my fear. For a moment, I allow myself to relax in his embrace, and then step back, still trembling.
"Are you okay?"
he demands.
"What's wrong?"
I have no words. I simply shake my head and point at the door. Li Wei gives me a once-over, and proceeds toward the house to investigate. By the time he returns, I have calmed down a little. I'm embarrassed to show such weakness, but the memory of those grinning skulls is haunting. Li Wei wears a tight expression, and I see he's carrying the statue I dropped. "What are you doing?" I ask. "We shouldn't take anything. This place is cursed." Li Wei tucks the little Pishu into his pocket.
"That house, perhaps, but not this statue. The carving is incredible. I've heard about statues like these. People used to keep them in their homes for prosperity and good fortune."
"It didn't help these people," I point out. Li Wei's face turns grimmer.
"I don't know what happened in there, but I think it has little to do with the supernatural and more to do with man. Let's check out the rest of these buildings and figure it out."
Maybe he's right. This village is too similar to our own. We have to find out what happened here to ensure that our village doesn't share this one's fate. "How do you suggest we search?" I ask.
"Wait here,"
he says. He hurries off into the largest building in the settlement, one that looks less like a house and more like some sort of administrative or educational facility. It's eerie being left alone in this ghostly village, but I refuse to let superstition get the best of me. When Li Wei comes back out, there's excitement on his face.
It's just as I was hoping. There are records in there, almost like what we keep. It looks like this was where their elders resided. Can you get started going through those writings? They might be able to tell us what happened here, and you're better at understanding that sort of thing than I am.
What are you going to do? I ask. He gestures around.
Continue searching the rest of the houses. I think those records will have most of our answers, but we need to rule everything out.
Be careful, I say. He nods, heading off toward one of the houses. I watch him a few moments, and then turn toward the administrative building. It's smaller than the art school at home, or our magistrate's center. But then this village is also much smaller. The building is in a similar state as the house I was just in, smelling of dust and decay. But thankfully there are no skeletons or other signs of the dead to keep me company. The room Li Wei referred to is similar to our library at the Peacock Court, and it has kept out the worst of the moisture and other damaging elements. Wall racks hold a neat collection of scrolls, and the rest of the room is dedicated to storing what looks like this village's equivalent of daily records. They're smaller than ours, and not nearly as elaborate as the murals we create, nor do they show the artistic flair and precision that we are encouraged to put into our work. But they are factual and orderly, and contain the information I need to unravel what has happened in this village. I make myself comfortable and begin reading scrolls by the dusty light filtering in from a high window. What I discover is shocking. Numbing, even. I lose track of time, and am only startled out of my study when I hear Li Wei's steps in the adjacent hall. "Did you find anything?" I ask when he enters. I manage to appear calm, but inside, I'm reeling.
"More than I wanted," he tells me. "Most of the homes are empty, but others have bones as well. I don't know what killed them."
"I do," I say, setting down one of the records. "Starvation and sickness." My attempts at control begin to falter. My hands are shaking, and I clasp them in my lap. It's not fear that has unsettled me so much as shock.
"Do you want to go outside to talk?"
Li Wei asks.
"It's getting warmer."
I nod. I feel chilled in this place full of memories and ghosts. I need to be back out in the sun, back among living and growing things. We travel toward last night's camp, but just as we are at the edge of the village, we encounter another gruesome sight. Skeletons shackled to a stone block. My stomach turns at the thought of the terrible fate they must have endured there. Characters etched into the stone condemn them for their crime. Food thieves. With a shudder, I avert my gaze and see Li Wei scowling. I'm not surprised he's upset, considering the way he protected the thief in our village.
"This is savage," he states. "At least our people have never taken punishment to such an extreme."
"They might," I say, thinking of what I learned, "if our village ever has to face what this one did."
"What do you mean?"
he asks. We reach our camp, now enjoying the full force of morning sunlight. It helps chase away the gloom of what I uncovered in the library, but only a little. Li Wei looks at me expectantly once we are there. "They were like us," I tell him finally. "Exactly like us. A mining town. They lost their hearing and became trapped up here, with no easy way to climb down. But they established a deal with the township. They had their own line and sent metals down the mountain in exchange for food. And just like us, they began to go blind." Those similarities are still too shocking, too unbelievable, and that's what makes it hard to keep going. This village's history was so much like our own, Had I just taken a walk in my own future? Is this what's in store for us in 10 years, 5 years, 1 year? Fear makes me lose track of my story, not for myself, but for those we left behind. What fate is waiting for Zhang Jing, for the masters and other students?
What happened? How did they die?
Li Wei asks, his expression urgent.
Fei, you said starvation.
I swallow and try to regain my composure. With blindness, their mining output depleted, and just like with us, the township started limiting their food. They weren't exactly like us. They stopped feeding their beggars altogether. The blindness also resulted in more accidents, so some died that way too. Near the end, their water supply got contaminated. The record keepers believed some of the bodies weren't disposed of properly and fouled the water. People grew sick and died before they discovered the problem. It was a couple of years ago, so it eventually cleared, I add, seeing him shoot a concerned look at our canteens. By then, there was hardly anyone left. The township stopped food shipments completely, and chaos broke out. Those that didn't die of starvation attempted to climb down, but it's unknown how many made it. The elevation is lower, but from what I've read, the stone on the cliffs below is softer, more prone to avalanches, less likely to hold ropes and body weight. Some may have escaped. Some didn't. Some may have thrown themselves over purposefully. I sink to the ground, unable to shake the thought of this happening to our village. Li Wei paces in front of me, his expression dark. He bravely investigated the ghost village, with all its horrors, but now I can tell his resolve is wavering. Or maybe he's just losing hope.
Is this what it comes to, then? He asks. Is this what our village can expect? Food disappearing altogether? Despair and hopelessness?
We can't know that, I say. We can't know anything until we speak to the linekeeper, and our village isn't like theirs. Not yet.
Isn't it? He asks angrily. It's already happening. The blindness has started. The metals have decreased. The food has decreased. Just the other day, the township said they were sending less as punishment. How much longer until they stop the food? How long until our own people turn on each other in desperation? Is this what my father died for? How many other villages has the township done this to?
I don't know. We must talk to the linekeeper.
We need to do something, he snaps, but I don't know if talking is enough.
Li Wei is understandably worked up, and I know it's for more than just the gruesome discoveries in this village. The pain of his father's death is still fresh, making everything that much worse. And desperate. He sighs.
Perhaps there was some misunderstanding with this village. Perhaps they asked for too much.
Perhaps, I agree. I can tell we're both trying to put on good faces for each other. In reality, I know we are both filled with doubts. We want to believe the best, that the linekeeper can help us, but we've seen and suffered too much. And if the linekeeper can't help, then what? It's that uncertainty that casts the real pall over us. I summon an image of Zhang Jing and muster my courage as I follow Li Wei to a spot he deems suitable for continuing our descent down the cliffs. The warnings of the writings stick with us, and he is extra cautious as he begins planting the ropes into the rock face. Some of the stone is softer in this area, and he won't let us descend until he's certain each stake and rope will hold. Even though we have less distance to cover than we did the previous day, it's still a long way down to the base of the mountain. Every inch we travel is filled with fear that the rock is going to crumble and loosen our stakes, sending us plummeting. More avalanches tumble after us, and again, my hearing only just saves us on more than one occasion. Sometimes I'm not quick enough, and we both earn new bruises and cuts to go with yesterday's injuries. Adding to all this is the knowledge that we are out of food. Hunger gnaws at the edges of my stomach. And yet a strange exhilaration is filling me as we get lower and lower and see the ground at the base of the mountain. A lush valley filled with trees spreads out before us, drawing nearer, and beyond it I can see a haze of green land that looks as though it has no trees at all. Is it possible that's farmland? The library has books about cultivation and growing, but after the avalanches cut off the passes to our village's fertile lands, farming has become as fantastic a concept as flying or hearing. Dreams of what may be waiting for us spur me on in the last stretch of our climb. Then, incredibly, we set foot on the ground. I look up and am stunned to see my own mountain and its neighbors towering off into the sky. I can't even see the tops, as early evening clouds have moved in. It's an entirely different perspective from the view I've seen my whole life. Peaks surrounding us and mist-covered depths below. I realize I'm standing in the place where my ancestors first migrated from, and that's a heady thought, too.
Ready to see what this place has to offer?
Li Wei asks. He walks over to me to undo the ropes that have bound us together. His hands work deftly on the knots around my waist, and I hope it's not obvious that I'm holding my breath. Again, I am amazed at how delicate his touch is for someone so large. When he finishes, his hands linger on my waist a fraction longer than they need to, and then he steps back. Do you know where to go? I ask. He puts a hand up to his eyes and scans around, taking in the sun's position over our mountain. We spent a lot of time in the empty village, and it will be evening soon. After a little scrutiny, he points to the north.
That is where our zip line descends. We've gotten a bit off course climbing down. We'll need to go over there to find its end, to find the line keeper.
I glance down at my dirty clothes and scraped hands, then make note of the late hour. Maybe we should rest and clean up tonight, I say. We aren't in any condition to parley with a man like him. Li Wei nods in agreement and adds,
It might very well be dark by the time we make it to his station. Let's explore a little and see if there's a good place for a camp.
He gestures around the expanse of woods.
Any preference?
I shake my head. You choose. He hesitates and then pulls out the little Pishu statue. He flips it once in the air and then skillfully catches it one-handed. The Pishu is facing east. Li Wei puts it back in his pack and says,
East it is.
We walk off into the eastern copse of woods, and I am particularly vigilant. I've learned that humans make a lot of noise in overgrown forest like this, so I'm mindful of sounds that might indicate we aren't alone. We run into nothing and no one troublesome, however, and soon find a small glen where a bubbling brook pools slightly before running off through the woods. It's a good spot to rest and clean, though we are nervous about lighting a fire when we might be close to civilized lands. Fortunately, it's warmer at this lower elevation, and we decide we can endure the night without a blaze.
You brought extra clothes to meet the line keeper?
Li Wei asks when he sees me getting out the other set I took from the school. I shrug. It just seemed practical. I wasn't thinking about him at the time, but now I'm glad. I want to represent our village honorably.
I guess I'll represent ours the only way I can,
he says, giving a wry glance to his own shirt. It's one of the dingy miner's garments, now torn and dappled with blood from the journey down. He left the white morning shirt back in the village.
But then, I'm a barbarian, so it's to be expected.
Perhaps we can clean it, I say, though I'm not so certain. Let me see it. He takes off his shirt without hesitation, and I try not to let my jaw drop. We engaged in all sorts of adventures and games as children, but none of them involved his shirt coming off. It's impossible not to be aware of his strength and build, even when he's dressed. Without the shirt, he's like one of the invincible heroes from the stories my father used to tell us. I take the shirt from him and try not to think about what Elder Lian would say about this situation I've inadvertently put myself in. There's a boulder overgrown with moss nearby, with a cup-like depression in its center. I pour water into it and do my best to soak and scrub the shirt, making a little progress, but not much. I'm fighting against dirt gathered from much more than just this journey. The linen is probably permanently dyed the color of the mines.
I didn't think artists had to do their own laundry,
he remarks as I work. I lift my wet hands to make a retort, but stop when inspiration hits. I go back to my pack and find my belt pouch, which I brought with me from the peacock court. It still contains the packets of pigment I used to bring with me on my observations. After a few moments, I select the one that makes green paint and dump its entire contents into the water. Li Wei comes up beside me, muscled arms crossed over his broad chest, and a curious expression on his face. I take a deep breath, more than aware of how close he's standing. If we can't get the dirt out, maybe we can cover it up, I explain. He looks dubious, and I add, well, it can't be any worse. Once it's set in the dye for a while, we'll hang it to dry in that tree. My hands freeze mid-sentence as my eye catches something. I forget all about dyes. I forget about shirts. I even briefly forget about Li Wei as I take in this new discovery. Most of the trees around here are evergreen, but a few are deciduous and just barely showing the signs of late summer giving way to autumn. The tree I'd nodded at is one, a kind I've never seen before. While I don't know what type it is, I do know what I see in its highest branches. I point, and Li Wei follows the motion, his eyes widening when he sees what I spotted. Fruit. No fruit trees grow in our village. We've tried planting seeds and pits on the rare occasions we receive fruit in the shipments, but they just don't take. I've always known fruit comes from trees, but seeing it here in the flesh is unbelievable. Maybe Li Wei's little statue is helping us after all. With food at such a premium where we come from, it's downright magical to find it growing on a tree in front of us, just waiting for us to pick and eat. If we can reach it. Li Wei strides over to the tree, then hesitates as he scrutinizes it more closely.
I can get up there, he tells me, but I'm not sure if the branches can support my weight, especially the high ones.
They can support my weight, I say confidently. He looks me over, glances at the tree, and then looks back at me.
It can probably support 10 of you. We just need to get you up there.
He beckons me over and holds out his arms to lift me. My indecision over his half-naked state and Elder Lian's disapproval is short-lived. I let go of my fears, and suddenly it is like we are children again, off on some adventure in the woods. I step forward, and he grips my waist, his strong hands careful as he raises me. I stretch my arms up, but can't quite reach the lowest branch. Li Wei shifts, sliding his hands down so that he can hold me up by my legs and raise me higher. For a moment, I lose my balance as he adjusts, and I slip down. He catches me before I can fall, and for the space of a heartbeat, he holds me in his arms, our bodies pressed together. As I meet his eyes, noting how very close we are, I think, no, we are not children. He seems to be thinking the same thing, and a flush fills his cheeks. Quickly he boosts me up again, holding me by my ankles so that I can reach higher. Resolutely, I push aside thoughts of the way his arms felt, or how the lingering scent of sandalwood still clings to him. My fingers make contact with a limb, and from there I'm at last able to swing myself up and begin scaling the rest of the tree's branches. They're small and thin, but I find enough that can support me until I reach the fruit at the very top. Up close, I see it's almost at the end of its season and starting to wither. I pluck one and sniff, grinning when I recognize persimmon. It's a rare treat in our village, occasionally given to us chopped up with other food. I glance down at Liu Wei, who is watching me anxiously.
"Be careful," he signs. "We didn't just survive a lethal mountain climb only to have you fall from a fruit tree."
By way of answer, I toss the persimmon down to him and then begin picking all the rest. There are about a dozen total, and when I've thrown them all down, I climb back, feeling a bit of pride that I'm able to swing off the last branch and land without his help.
"It must be true," he says wonderingly.
He has gathered all the persimmons together.
"We've been in the lowlands for barely an hour and have already stumbled across food. They must have an abundance."
"Someone came through and picked over the rest of the tree earlier in the season," I point out. "There may be people nearby." He nods, growing serious.
"We'll be careful tonight and take watches again."
We make a dinner of the persimmons, prudently saving some for tomorrow's journey, though I know we're both secretly hoping to find more food along the way. When we finish eating, I take his shirt out of the dye. It isn't as dark a green as I'd hoped, but it's definitely an improvement. I change into my clean robe and give him my travel-stained one to wear overnight. He can't even fully cinch it, leaving a comical gap over his chest, but at least it will provide warmth. We are in good spirits as we settle down for the night, playing another round of xing qi before the sun goes down. I still can't beat him, and he gently tries to coach me.
"The moves you make seem good, but you aren't thinking far enough into the future. Plan at least 2 moves ahead of your opponent."
I sigh. You'd think I'd be better at that, with all the planning and organizing I normally have to do in my work. A small hesitation is the only sign of Li Wei's unease as he asks,
"Is marrying Sheng part of your plans?"
The question catches me completely off guard. Sheng has never come up in conversation between us before. Honestly, Sheng hasn't even crossed my mind on this trip. "It's part of the elders' plans," I respond carefully.
"I see."
"You know how it is," I add when he says nothing more. "You can't be surprised at that. Artists always marry other artists."
"Yes, but does it have to be him?"
asks Li Wei, a wry look on his face.
"It seems like there are better choices among the apprentices. Sheng is so..."
"Arrogant? Obnoxious?" I supply. Now Li Wei looks surprised.
"That doesn't bother you?"
"I don't think much about it," I say. "He is the best apprentice among the boys. I am the best girl. The elders think it is a wise match."
"But that is all?"
Li Wei pushes.
"It's the elders who want the match, not you."
"It doesn't matter," I remind him. "I will still abide by their wishes." Li Wei is indignant.
"You shouldn't marry because of someone else's wishes, because it's a wise match. You should marry someone who loves you, someone who loves you passionately and would change the world for you."
"The world would have to change indeed for that to happen," I point out. "Do you see it changing any time soon?" He gestures around us.
"It already has, Faye."
"Not enough," I say after several long, weighted moments. I know what he is hinting at, and need to discourage it. And even if it did, what was between us is in the past.
So you say. But you've done an awful lot to keep me alive.
He gestures at the green shirt.
And well-dressed.
Only so you won't embarrass me, I say loftily.
Whatever you say, apprentice,
he replies. He prepares for bed with a glint in his eye. And I know he doesn't believe me. Chapter 9. More strange dreams plague my sleep that night. I again feel as though something or someone is calling out to me, this time through a mist. I run through it, trying to find my way, but only grow more and more disoriented. Soon, I lose sense of whether someone is trying to reach out to me, or capture me. I begin running, full of panic, and unable to see my destination. I wake up with a start, flailing and terrified. To my astonishment, Li Wei is kneeling by my makeshift bed, and before I know what I'm doing, I throw myself into his arms. The phantoms in my dream fade, and his presence grounds me, calming me down. He strokes my hair gently, and it takes me a moment to slip from his embrace. Sorry about that, I say.
I was worried,
he tells me.
You were so restless, tossing and turning, kicking. And this isn't the first time I've seen it while you're sleeping.
It isn't? I ask, feeling mortified.
What are you dreaming of that upsets you so much?
He asks. Although he knows about my hearing, I haven't told him the full details of how it started, or my recurring dreams of being called to. I nearly tell him now, but something fearful and personal holds me back. It's nothing, I say, getting to my feet. Sorry for worrying you. He touches my arm briefly, turning me so I must face him.
Fay, I'm here for you. No matter what else has happened between us, I hope you know that. Don't be afraid to tell me anything.
I nod, but don't elaborate. How can I explain what I myself don't understand? He doesn't press me for answers as we get ready for the day. We eat all but 2 persimmons and finish cleaning ourselves up. Li Wei's new shirt, now fully dry, has ended up as a kind of sickly green, but it's still better than before. I stand before him, helping smooth some of the fabric as I survey him with a critical eye. I guess you'll do, I say, certainly not about to admit that even in rags he is magnificent. I feel confident in my own clean set of artist's clothes, though I wish I'd thought to pack a girl set. It isn't completely unheard of for women to wear pants in our village, but the more I think about meeting a venerable figure like the line keeper, the more I wish I could put on a strong, formal appearance. I remember when I first interviewed to help out with the artists, I tell Li Wei as we are breaking camp, before I officially became an apprentice. I had to undergo extensive tests and interviews. My mother scrubbed me until I hurt and traded 3 days' worth of her own rations for some new cloth to make me a robe. When you're meeting someone in power, someone with the ability to change your life for better or worse, it's important you show them you're worth it, she told me. I pause, feeling a bittersweet tug at the memory. My mother had died before learning the results. I wonder what she would think of me now, going to see the line keeper, dressed like a boy. Li Wei grins, revealing a phantom dimple I've always liked.
You might be dressed like a boy, but no one's going to think you're one.
Despite his teasing, there is a heated undercurrent in his words, and I can't help but think of our conversation last night. You should marry someone who loves you. Someone who loves you passionately and would change the world for you. Has it changed? I wonder. And will I be able to change with it? Those thoughts weigh on me. But as the sun rises higher, concern for Zhang Jing is more pressing. When I finished pinning up my hair, I ask, is there anything else we need to do? Should we work out what we're going to say to the linekeeper?
We'll tell him our problems and ask for help,
Li Wei says simply. The answer doesn't surprise me. Li Wei is more straightforward about some things than I am. Coming from the Peacock Court, where we work with more structure and formalities, I'm hesitant just to rush forward without a concrete plan. You're still assuming that what happened to the other village was part of some misunderstanding, I say. What if it wasn't? What if he knows and did nothing?
Then we will have nothing to do with him,
Li Wei says.
We'll take matters into our own hands.
I don't know how I feel about that, or how we'd even go about it. But I decide not to argue the matter until we know for sure the linekeeper was complicit. For now, we must go to him and find out what we can. The usual morning mist covers the mountains, but the day is warming quickly, promising us that summer hasn't quite left yet. Li Wei has a better sense of how and where we descended the mountain, and he leads us back in the direction of the zip line. We walk through more forest, seeing little sign of human civilization, but keeping our eyes open for more persimmons or other edibles. We also pass a few small woodland animals, causing us both to pause in contemplation. Game is as rare as agriculture up in our village, and sadly, animals usually don't last long due to the lack of sustenance in our rocky soil. We make no attempts at hunting today, not when we're so near our goal. Soon enough, we see the line coming down the mountain, suspended high over the trees and treacherous cliffs. Seeing it this way is just as surreal to me as this new bottom view of the mountains. For all my life, I've seen shipments of precious food come up that line from a mysterious location. Never did I dream we'd arrive there, or that it would be so underwhelming. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but it certainly wasn't a small, nondescript shed at the base of the zip line. Sitting beside it, getting what shade he can from the overhanging of the thatched roof, is a middle-aged man with thinning hair. Two things about him strike me immediately. The first is his clothing. It's made of cotton, just like my artist's attire. But there's a freshness to it that's rarely seen in our village, where cloth is at such a premium that new clothing is a luxury. The other thing about him that takes me aback is that he's plump. Outside of babies and drawings from old stories, I've never really seen anyone with extra fat, and I find myself gaping. Li Wei and I stand there, neither of us sure what to do. The man is slumped against the shack's walls, looking as though he might be dozing. Li Wei shifts slightly, making his pack rattle, and the man's eyes open in surprise. He can hear, I realize. He jumps to his feet, putting a rumpled cotton hat on his head, and looks between our faces expectantly. Then something truly remarkable happens. Sound comes from his lips. It's not a scream, not laughter. It's like nothing I've yet encountered in my brief experience with hearing. A series of rapid sounds of different lengths and shapes. I realize, with a start, that I must be hearing human speech for the first time. Only, I have no idea what it means, and I certainly have no idea how to make it in return. Hesitantly, I lift my hands. Our records say that the language we use with our hands is based on a pre-existing one used by our migratory ancestors, specifically those who lost hearing through diseases or other known causes. I have no idea if that means others in the lowlands still use this method of communication, or if only those without hearing do. Regardless, I bow, and then I sign a greeting. Hello, most exalted Limekeeper. My name is Fei, and this is Li Wei. We have traveled a great distance from the village on the top of the mountain to speak with you about grave matters. The man gapes, and his eyes bug out. It's clear that he doesn't understand what I've said, but it seems to me he recognizes that I was speaking with my hands, as though perhaps he's encountered others who do as well.
What do we do?
Li Wei asks me when no immediate answer comes. I make a motion of painting or writing with my hand and then look at the man expectantly. The linekeeper occasionally sends notes to communicate with us, so surely he must keep supplies here. I think my meaning is clear, but it takes a few more repeated attempts before he understands. When he does, he shakes his head, which surprises me. How is he communicating with our lead supplier if he has no writing tools on hand? Stumped, we resort to much more basic attempts. Li Wei touches my shoulder and his own chest, then points up to the top of the mountain, tracing along the zip line. He then signals that we have descended the mountain, coming to this spot. I watch the linekeeper closely as Li Wei maneuvers, and I feel myself growing increasingly puzzled. This isn't at all the kind of man I expected. At the very least, I imagine someone a little more intelligent. Maybe we can't communicate in the same language, but Liu Wei's gesturing is pretty basic. The man finally seems to grasp where we've come from, and that realization almost frightens him. He shifts from foot to foot, looking troubled and conflicted. At last, he gestures that we should sit down. He points at himself, then at the small dirt road winding away from the shed, and indicates he will return. When Li Wei takes a couple of steps forward to suggest we accompany him, the man frantically shakes his head and reiterates that we should sit and wait. Li Wei and I exchange looks. What else can we do? I ask. Maybe he's going to get someone who knows our language, or at least some paper and ink. Our deliberation slams to a halt when the man hurriedly goes inside the shed and returns with a crate. He sits it on the ground and opens it, beckoning us over. We come closer, and I can't help but gasp. The crate is filled with food. I've never seen so much at once. Small buns, radishes, onions, rice, dried fruit. It is staggering, and I know my awe is reflected in Li Wei's face. The man gestures grandly that it is for us, his motion sweeping and generous. He urges us to sit down and eat while he is gone, and it is an offer we have a very difficult time refusing. The persimmons were a joyous discovery, but the one I ate this morning didn't make much of a filling breakfast. The man watches a few moments more as we look over the box, and then he begins making his way down the road that leads from the mountain, occasionally glancing back. He seems uneasy, nervous even. There were more crates in the shed, and I wonder if he thinks we'll take advantage of his hospitality by helping ourselves to more than was offered. I wish I had the words to reassure him and tell him how grateful we are for what he's given. But my bows only go so far. When he is nearly out of sight around a curve in the road, Li Wei pauses in feasting to ask me,
"Do you think that in eating this, we're taking away from our village's rations?"
I freeze mid-bite. It's a terrible thought, and I glance down at the crate guiltily. We've each already eaten more than a normal ration in our village. After some thought, I shake my head. That would be poor hospitality on his part. I don't think the linekeeper is a man like that. He's given us this as welcome, as a way of showing generosity, and clearly he has more. For the first time, I'm daring to hope this plan might truly result in change for my village. Despite a worrisome voice in my head that keeps pointing out how things didn't work out for that other village, Li Wei chews some dried fruit, his brow furrowed in thought.
I don't think that's the line keeper.
I raise an eyebrow. Who else would it be?
I don't know, he admits. A servant? But don't you think he behaved strangely? He's so unsure of himself. The line keeper always speaks with authority and seems so decisive. This man jumps at his own shadow.
I did think it was weird that he didn't have paper or writing tools around, I concede. Especially with all the notes he writes us.
Li Wei nods. Exactly. Something doesn't feel right.
He gazes off down the road, winding through the trees. Our host is long out of sight.
I'm not sure if we should wait for him to come back. This might be a trap.
What kind of trap? I ask in surprise. And to what end?
I don't know that either. It's just my gut. But the gift of food aside, he didn't seem very welcoming. I'm afraid of whom he's going to bring back.
I point at the crate. But this is what we came for. It's right in front of us. Food and the potential to feed our people. If we leave after he gifted us with this and told us to stay, what kind of message will that send? Where is the honor in that? Li Wei is torn, and the irony of our situation isn't lost on me. Until now, he has been the one so brazen and certain great things would come of this trip, while I worried. Now I am the one who wants to trust it will be fine, while he has doubts. He looks back down the road and makes a decision.
From what we know, that road probably leads to the township. If he's seeking help or supplies, it makes sense that's where he'd go. I say we go there ourselves and try to get a better sense of what's going on, of what these people are like. If I'm wrong, we can apologize later, claim we didn't understand his directions. If I am right, and there is something sinister going on...
He doesn't elaborate, and he doesn't need to. Not with the memory of the ghost village fresh in our minds. Instead, he simply shrugs and adds,
Well, that's what I think, at least. But I'm only the advisor.
I give a faint smile at the joke of referring to himself as Xiang Ji's second most powerful piece. But there's little humor in anything else. Between the line keeper's strange behavior and what we read in the other village, it's clear that caution is vital. Okay, I say, let's go, and let's take some of this food with us. He did offer us the crate. We follow the road away from the mountain, and I try not to think about how much farther I'm getting from the only home I've ever known. The road widens as we walk down it, the dirt smooth and hard-packed from many feet and wagons. I have read enough to know that our village is small in comparison to other settlements, that there are people in the world who live in much larger and more populated settlements and cities. The reality of that has never hit me until now, when I try to imagine the number of people who would require such a large road. Soon the road changes from dirt to flat stones, and that too is another surprise. We have nothing even remotely comparable in our small village. I eventually detect sounds that indicate others are ahead of us, and I put out an arm to stop Li Wei. I motion that we should get off the road and walk where we will have the cover of the trees to keep us from immediate discovery. He agrees. We both want to believe the best of these new people, but we are also too tense from our dangerous journey here to assume anything or anyone is safe. We make the rest of our journey in the woods, keeping the road in sight. When we reach the township at last, however, it isn't fear that dominates my emotions. It is awe. Just as I knew there were larger settlements outside of our village, I've always known the township is one such place. The road was my first clue, but now... Face to face with this place, I am truly stunned by just how much it dwarfs my home, and I'm only seeing it from the outside. The township is walled and gated. Men with weapons watch from atop wooden towers embedded in the walls, and they interrogate those who come to the gate. There is a backup on the road right now, some sort of delay with a group near the front, leaving about 50 people waiting impatiently to get inside. 50 people? That's more than all of the Peacock Court's residents. Something tells me this is only a small part of what we'll find inside, if we can get inside. The holdup seems to be over a wagon at the front of the line, and the sight of it, or rather what's pulling it, leaves both Li Wei and me transfixed. Horses. We've read about them in books, of course, but neither of us has ever dreamed of seeing them in real life. Back when the mountain passes were open, our ancestors brought a few domesticated animals with them. Those eventually died off, and when avalanches shut off the overland routes, bringing animals up the zip line was simply impossible. I've never seen a creature so big, and I'm struck by the horse's beauty. That itch to paint overcomes me, a burning need to capture the blue-black sheen of the animal's coats, and the way they toss their heads as they wait for their masters to finish. I drag my gaze from the horses and try to assess what else is happening. I hear more of those sounds, speech sounds, like I heard the linekeeper using, and I'm both perplexed and intrigued. The noises are nonsensical, but some intrinsic part of me understands that they are a means of communication, the sort of vocalization referred to in our ancient records. I wonder how long it takes to learn speech like that. I'm already swimming in more sounds and stimuli than I can keep track of. In fact, the mixture of so many different noises coming from so many different people is starting to make my head hurt again. But even if I can't understand the words, I recognize the signs of quarrel. The man sitting in the lead wagon is even fatter than the linekeeper, and it's clear he's upset about something. The guards appear equally annoyed, and the sounds coming out of all their mouths grow increasingly louder as the discussion continues. The animosity radiating from all of them unnerves me. At one point, the man in the wagon opens a crate and lifts out a bolt of yellow silk. Li Wei and I both gasp. Never have I seen such a thing. Any silk that made its way to our village was already in scraps, at best, used only as adornment for those of high rank. To see a swath of it like this is mesmerizing. Equally astonishing is its color, a rich, vibrant gold that is far superior to any dye we've ever managed to manufacture.
"Perhaps he is the king," suggests Li Wei. "How else would he have such luxury? It would also explain how he's able to eat so much."
"I don't think so," I reply, observing the argument. "I don't think the guards would be having this kind of dispute with a king." The guards eventually insist on checking every crate in the wagon, much to the annoyance of their owner and those in line on the road. Several people, apparently the man's servants, look weary and wander from the wagon as the guards conduct their search. I continue watching with wide eyes as more and more exquisite bolts of silk are revealed in an unending rainbow of colors. Only in my dreams have I envisioned such radiance.
"How will we get in?" asks Li Wei. "If they're this cautious about cloth, they're probably extra suspicious of outsiders, especially based on the linekeeper's reaction."
I agree, and an answer suddenly presents itself. The wagon search finishes, and the fat man makes a loud sound that brings the meandering servant scurrying back. I grab Li Wei's arm and hurry us forward into the crowd. With so many people waiting and mingling about, nobody pays attention to us. The search completed, the guards are eager to wave the silk owner and his retinue through.
Li Wei and I fall in behind some of the servants and move quickly as the guards direct us to the gates. Just as we are about to step through, a guard suddenly steps out